Nicaragua with sanctions after the incumbent Daniel Ortega wins the Central American country's race for president. The Yemeni army's air defenses shoot down a spy drone over the Flashpoint province of Ma'arib. And thousands of New Zealand turning out to show their disapproval of the government's lockdowns and COVID vaccine mandates. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. This is news. The incumbent Daniel Ortega winning Nicaragua's presidential election and clinching his fourth consecutive term in office. The Electoral Council says almost all ballots have been counted, and Ortega has won with over 76% of the votes. Ortega is hailing the results as a victory against terrorism and the enemies of Nicaragua. Washington and the European Union have rejected the results. U.S. Secretary of State says that his country is ready to use a range of tools, including sanctions and visa restrictions. He says that's against what he's calling the Nicaraguan government's undemocratic acts. President Joe Biden has also accused Ortega of orchestrating, quote, a pantomime election that was neither free nor fair. Russia, on the other hand, is supporting Nicaragua and says the Western reactions are unacceptable. We earlier asked our correspondent in Managua, Ahmed Caballo, to weigh in on the results of the election in Nicaragua. He believes the re-election of President Ortega is the people's choice, and the U.S. is in no position to cast doubts on the country's electoral process.
There were people, long queues yesterday, waiting to vote. Today, there were Sandinista supporters celebrating. Yesterday, when we came back from the National Assembly at 4 a.m. in the morning, there were street parties with people with Sandinista flags celebrating. So it's very clear, and I've been here for 7 days now, that the president and the Sandinista movement is very popular. And the United States doesn't get to decide what is and isn't a fair election. There's many controversies over the recent election between Joe Biden and the former president Donald Trump. Yet Nicaragua doesn't call the election result illegitimate and pantomime elections. So what gives the United States the right to do the same? It is not the world police as it tries to present itself. And the other European allies, the European Union, the United Kingdom, these are all interested in breaking up what is considered the new non-aligned movement, which involves Iran, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, Russia, China, countries that do not want to be dictated to by Washington.
A setback for the U.S. presidents. Poll is finding that Americans are increasingly dissatisfied with the way that Joe Biden is handling his job. The CNN poll puts Biden's overall approval rating at 48%. 38% of those surveyed said that they strongly disapprove of his performance. The poll also suggests that 58% of Americans believe that Biden has not been paying attention to the country's most pressing issues, including the economy. An analysis of the data indicates the dip in Biden's approval has been due to disappointment among his original supporters. That casts doubt on the Democrats' ability to maintain their edge over their Republican rivals in the 2022 midterm elections. Just over 1,000 adults participated in the poll conducted between November 1st and 4th. The reported margin of error was 4 percentage points. We talked to political commentator Ian Williams to get his thoughts on Biden's declining approval rating. He says that Biden fails to see the overall agenda, and that spurs a Republican backlash against him.
Joe Biden is not brilliant at messaging. He doesn't emphasize it. He's actually performed better than many of us expected. He has just won a significant quasi-victory to get a stimulus bill through. He has managed to get most of the country vaccinated. But what he doesn't do is to seize the agenda. And that's where the Republicans are in. He has wrestled with the Supreme Court and the abortion issue, which is not completely a vote winner amongst women, but it means that he has to waste time on that when the big issue is getting people healthy, getting people employed, and making sure that people stay solvent. And he's been trying to do that, but he can't do it in a very spectacular way. He can't pull a white rabbit out of his electoral hat, even though he's tried. And he keeps letting the Trumpers dominate the agenda. And his own party. I mean, the point is that nobody sees any difference now between Trump and the Republican Party. They come as a package, whereas Biden has to carry all of the sins of the Democratic Party. So he has two complete right-wing corporate shrills holding the country to ransom. That's the Democratic Party. That's part of his responsibility as the Democratic president. People see that as a reflection of his failure because he hasn't taken them out and politically at least shot them. He hasn't been able to discipline them, which makes him look weak.
The large caravan of migrants coming from Central America is now heading to the U.S. border rather than the originally planned Mexico City. The change in plans come after reports of clashes with Mexican police forces and detentions in the past days. The caravan leaders say that thousands of migrants are set to join the group later and set out for the border. The group, once as large as 4,000, began its journey 2 weeks ago. However, it has dwindled after walking for hundreds of kilometers through heat and clashes with migration officers. Washington is pressuring Mexico to contain them before they reach the U.S. Migration agents are increasingly using tough tactics to stem the influx. Another Palestinian prisoner is facing a critical health condition after a prolonged hunger strike in objection to the Israeli jail system. Palestinian media say that Kayet Fasfous has been refusing to eat for 118 days now. He is among six inmates on lengthy and life-threatening hunger strikes against their indefinite detention. Hundreds of Palestinian administrative detainees have stopped eating in protest. They also complain about the hostile jail conditions, including harassment and torture. The United Nations has expressed grave concern about the lives of the Palestinian hunger strikers. Administrative detention is illegal under international law, but Israel uses it to lock up Palestinians without charge or trial indefinitely. New developments out of the southern province of Ma'arib in Yemen. We are learning that just a short while ago, the Yemeni air defenses shot down an unmanned spy drone in the airspace of Juba district there. Ma'arib has been for some time been a flashpoint of conflict between the Yemeni army and Israeli fighters on the one side and the mercenary forces supported by Saudi Arabia and the UAE on the other. Yemeni forces have been inching closer to fully liberating the province. They are already controlling Juba district. That is the last area that was held by militias in the south of the strategic city of Ma'arib. Earlier, we spoke with our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdullatif Abu Shali. He has given us more details about the type of aircraft that the Yemeni army shut down, as well as the total number of drones downed over Yemen this year.
The U.S.-made drone was hovering over Al-Juba district to carry out some hostility activities against the Yemeni people, against the people of Al-Juba district, the people of Ma'arib. This is the fifth drone of the Scan Eagle, actually, type to be shot down during this year, and it was shot down by a weapon that was not revealed by the Yemeni army. Yet the spokesman of the Yemeni army, General Brigadier Hassari, said this kind of weapons will be revealed soon, inshallah, to show the world the capabilities of the Yemeni army, how the Yemeni army managed to improve and develop its own armed air defense to defend the airspace of the Yemeni land, the Yemeni soil, to defend the sovereignty of the country. Military sources say that this kind of drones is being operated and run by U.S. experts, as the United States is attempting to maintain the reputation of the U.S.-made weapons.
Senior Iraqi officials have decried Saturday's drone attack on the residence of Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi in Baghdad's high-security green zone. The condemnation came at a meeting between Kadhimi and members of Iraq's Resistance Coordination Committee. President Barham Saleh and the head of the country's judiciary were also in attendance. The officials also denounced Friday's deadly clashes between security forces and protesters, voicing their anger at the outcome of the recent parliamentary elections. They called on all sides to find peaceful resolutions to de-escalate tensions and address the crisis. Iraqis have held several rallies across the country since October 10th vote. The initial tally put the bloc of influential cleric Muqtada al-Sadr in the lead. Protesters, however, say that numerous violations were recorded during the voting and counting processes. Political commentator Firas Al-Najim says attempts are being made to demonize and to sideline Iraq's resistance factions.
They want the resistance groups to, you know, be defamed and to look like they are the ones that are not respecting the law of the country, and that they are a danger to the security and the future of Iraq. But, you know, the Prime Minister of Iraq as well is, you know, he's influenced as well by the U.S. And different factions and different influencers in the region. And, you know, he needs to understand and he needs to recognize that the resistance are the ones that liberated Iraq, and they're the main people that care about the security of Iraq, and that they have a future in the security of Iraq and the foreign politics of Iraq as well. And we see a scenario where the protesters that were aligned with the axis of resistance inside Iraq were shot peacefully when they were protesting against, you know, the results of the elections, because they've seen a lot of different, you know, violations and possible fraud. So this is their, you know, their basic rights that they can go out there and protest. And they got shot.
Syrian air defenses have thwarted fresh Israeli missile strikes targeting central and the western regions of the Arab country. Earlier, our Damascus correspondent Mohammed Ali joined us with the details.
Israel carried out yet a new attack on Syria. Almost every week or two, Israel attacks various parts of the country. This time, according to an official military source here, at about 7:16 p.m. local time, Israeli fighter jets flying in an area north of the Lebanese capital, Beirut, launched missiles at various Syrian army positions in central Syria, around Homs, and also in areas in the coastal part of the country. The Syrian army says that air defenses were able to intercept most of the enemy missiles. However, it seems that some of them did hit their targets, because the official source carried on to say in a statement that the Israeli attack injured two Syrian army soldiers and also caused some material damages. Now, definitely, this is not the first kind of attack in which Israel carried this out. Such an aggression from violating even Lebanese airspace most of the times. Just about a month ago, there was a similar attack on the same area in Homs countryside that killed a soldier and injured three others. And also a week ago, there were a couple of attacks around Damascus. It's very important to say that the Syrian government, the foreign ministry, always sends letters to the UN calling and urging the international body to shoulder its responsibility in blocking future attacks by Israel and forcing Israel to respect international resolutions, UN resolutions, also the sovereignty of Syria. However, we haven't even heard condemnation from international organizations, not to speak of any action.
The Iranian army has wrapped up a massive maneuver in the Strait of Hormuz, the Sea of Oman, and the north of the Indian Ocean. The military exercise is aimed at boosting coordination between the four branches of Iran's military. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Senior military commanders parade and salute army soldiers as the last phase of a three-day maneuver, codenamed Zulfaqar 1400. The military exercise engaged the four branches of the Iranian army and was held over a million square kilometer area, stretching from the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf to the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean. Army commanders say the drill was a success and it carries regional and global messages.
The Islamic Republic has in recent years proved that it can be the axis of regional security, which entails a collective regional cooperation. If regional states join hands, they can protect the security of the region without the need to rely on foreigners. History has shown that foreign countries would never bring sustainable security to any nation.
The massive drill kicked off on Sunday with surface and subsurface vessels, air and naval flights, radars and missile systems. The Army also deployed its latest combat and reconnaissance drones, which are produced domestically. The Islamic Republic takes great pride in indigenizing its defense arsenal against the backdrop of an all-out sanctions regime by the U.S. that blocks Iran's access to even a bullet from other countries.
The Iranian army is prepared to confront any force that could possibly threaten Iran's territorial integrity and interests. Using our indigenous defense equipment, we are capable of defending our soil and will nip in the bud any threat from our enemies.
Situated in a geopolitically sensitive region, Iran holds regular drills as a means to enhance its preparedness in the face of possible threats, such as terrorism and piracy. Iran's armed forces have on different occasions underscored that the country will not be the first to pull the trigger, and its military doctrine is based on deterrence, not aggression.
The three-day military exercise wrapped up with important messages. On top of them is that Iran is strongly opposed to any foreign presence in the regional waters, describing it as destabilizing and provocative. The Iranian army says Iran and other regional countries are the ones that are responsible for ensuring the security of the region. And this means extraterritorial forces must go home. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
The New Zealand government's coronavirus restrictions, including compulsory vaccinations, have angered many there. Hours ago, the capital, Wellington, became the scene of a big protest against those policies. Thousands of people marched on the parliament. They held signs and chanted slogans, demanding a return to what they called the pre-pandemic freedoms. Unprecedented security measures were in place, and both entrances to the building were closed off. The government has changed its strategy from lockdowns to mandatory vaccination for all. New Zealand has largely fended off the pandemic with under 8,000 total cases and only 32 deaths. But the new Delta variant has raised concerns, with 125 new cases reported on Tuesday. With that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Simple question.
A British trawler set sail to catch some fish, but instead got caught up in a political dragnet that has also carried the British and the French premiers into heavy weather of their own. And while it may look like a dispute about fishing rights, many believe that the true conflict here is not about trawling the oceans at all, but rather part of the fallout from the politically divisive, emotionally charged and some would say internationally destabilizing decision by the United Kingdom to withdraw from the European Union.
The captain of the Cornelis Jurtjan has been accused of acts of unauthorized sea fishing in French maritime salt waters by a third-party vessel to the European Union. While British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss labelled the French completely unreasonable, France responded by pointing angrily at the refusal of Britain to give certain French trawlers fishing rights in British waters. However, a subtext was exposed by the release of French Prime Minister Jean Castex's message to Ursula von der Leyen, that's the President of the European Commission, asking the EU to take further steps in the fishing row in a firm, united and proportional way to show that leaving the EU causes more damage than staying in. The impact has been very public and very damaging. Whitehall officials claimed the French Prime Minister's suggestion had ruined all trust between the UK and France and branded his note a punishment letter. With provocative responses from the French, Anglo-French relations have been described as close to Brexit meltdown, with threats of legal action by both sides and secondary threats such as cutting off the French power supply to the island of Jersey.
What's gone wrong between these two old allies, Britain and France? How can an argument about a fishing dispute escalate into an international crisis? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this question. How does the public feel about the fact the French, whose embassy in London is here behind me, have seized a British fishing vessel and held it in the port of Le Havre? We put that to the public here in London. This is what they said.
I think it's quite petty in light of everything that's going on in the world. I think if we can't resolve that, what hope have we got with COP26?
I don't know. Now things are changing a lot. I don't know, maybe with the COP26, it's interesting. I like the relationship between the two countries. Very interesting, and we learned a lot in class, in school.
It seems to be a little bit of tit for tat. I mean, I know the whole Brexit, one of the key promises were about the fisheries and being able to have access, but in the grand scheme of things, I don't really think that affects that many people, so to be honest, I don't really care too much.
As you know, the French government is really strict about what they wish to. They really wish to keep their our like fish and stuff for us, so that the most important we see after our I'm living in UK since 1 year, so I've seen that with an extra point of view. But I can see that the French government do not wish to leave anything to the UK as far like all the Brexit matter and stuff. So for me, I think it's really important to keep what we own and being stretched in our mind as well about the policies and the difference of ocean that we have between the UK and France. After, I think it's stupid to go on a big beef like it is now and not finding any agreement on anything. I think with more talking and reasoning, it would be easy to find something to do.
I think it's a kind of revenge of not giving the authorization. I mean, from the French perspective, I mean, the Brits have been playing tricky by not giving the authorization that they should get. Mm-hmm. This is a French perspective. So I think it's just a question of showing muscles and seizing the boat, which is supposed not to have any authorization. But this is all about political gesticulations. And you never know what is the truth behind that. So
I think the big boys need to get on the table and start talking rather than just having this charade of missiles flying and everything else. I think they just need to get on the table and talk like adults.
Well, how can they? If it's not theirs, how can they impound it? Like, is that legal? Does it sound right? What can we do about it? It sounds a bit crazy.
I mean, it's just more of the same nonsense. I don't blame the French for it at all. I just think we've kind of really not played our hand very well over Brexit. So that's really what it's about for me.
I think it's political games, and it's a bit of a shame that we can't just come to some agreement between parties.
the British Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary have described French threats as completely unreasonable. But does the public think this is really about fishing rights or something else?
Maybe, probably, yeah. It's making them cold. I don't know, colder than before. I think so.
I certainly think that there is an element of tit for tat with regards to, well, you did this, so therefore we're going to do that. But, you know, at the end of the day, it is about protecting industry. In some instances, you know, we've always had this lovely kind of blanket, which is the Common Agricultural Policy, which basically says we'll subsidise so much, and Common Fisheries Policies, which say we'll subsidise so much and effectively take away from other countries that would otherwise benefit. So, you know, you've got countries in Africa, in the Middle East, that simply can't afford it, simply because these two superpowers are having a spat, really. So, yeah, that's my general opinion, that you should do away with the whole kind of Common Agricultural Fisheries Policies and all that kind of jazz, just so that you can at least let people earn an honest living, as opposed to it being subsidised, and a lot of these countries then buying their buying their fish, which is naturally produced in their area, from other countries. So, you know, it makes it very difficult.
I think there's a lot more to it, because it's not all about fishing. I think Brexit has 90% of the whole thing behind it. It's not just fishing, because the French tourists can fish anywhere else. I think there's a lot of Brexit underneath, the undercurrent is Brexit itself.
It's a possibility, I suppose. Maybe they're having issues, but how is this going to solve it? Like, that's not going to make us reverse the decision and go back to before Brexit, so I don't really see the point of it, really. It's just going to be a tit for tat then, isn't it? If Britain's then going to do something, and it's just going to be a retaliation all the time. I don't see the point of it, really. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of factors. I don't think it's purely just down to fishing itself.
Yeah, I think it's a bit deeper. Since all the Brexit stuff, I mean, there's a lot of underlying feeling going on, you can tell. So, yeah, it's a bit more, I reckon.
I think there's a lot of subtext in a lot of these disputes that probably we don't hear about, and I think that it goes way beyond potentially things that are a little bit... Some people may think are trivial or that don't affect the kind of country at large, but it's part of a bigger thing, and I think there's still significant issues post-Brexit, and I think that there's still a lot of tensions to be resolved diplomatically between not only the UK and France, but a lot of EU nations in the UK.
The French and the British haven't got on for a long time, have they, to be honest, over many, many centuries. So, you know, this is all the fallout of Brexit, and albeit, you know, the fishing thing is a very, very small part of our overall sort of GDP and stuff like that, it's something for them to latch onto and flex their muscles post-Brexit.
Well, I know it's political. It's not just about fishing. Yeah, Brexit has a role to play. I know everyone is quite upset about it, but it shouldn't stop life from going on. It shouldn't stop any of those. And relationships are key to everything that we do. So it's good that we have a good relationship.
The French demanded a €150,000 fine be paid in order to secure the release of this boat. Now, that's far more than this vessel could possibly have earned in the course of this fishing trip. I asked the public why, in their view, the aggression, the dispute, the ultimatums escalated so far and so fast.
I think it's always a case where, you know, why it's escalated so quickly. I can't really answer that one for you, I'm sorry.
To the best of my knowledge, since hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Mm. Wasn't there like a huge war that lasted 100 years?
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I would think that there's underlying things, and again, I am not involved and have not enough knowledge to have an opinion on what's going on at the moment. But, yeah, throughout history there's been issues between, I don't know, neighboring countries.
It's important, like, it goes fast, like, you know, the fishing beef is ongoing since ages, so now it's getting to the end with the agreement, with the deadline that the French government give to UK, so I think it's important to handle that quite quickly, for the sake of everyone, either the English fishers or the French fishers, everyone is tired of that situation, even though Boris and Macron met in the COP20. COP26. 27. It's important to handle that beef fast for me.
Because we're running out of time. 6 months from election, any opportunity for the opponent of Mr. Macron can seize the opportunity to show that he's weak. So he has no time. He's running out of time. And all the candidates are positioning themselves, so any weakness can be really exploited by the by that. So never forget about the political context in France, which is going to be for the next 6 months very much like tense.
Yeah, that I don't know. It's like most of these stories, you don't actually get to know the background, you just hear the immediateness of it. And so, yeah, and it would be something I'd be interested to find out more about.
Yeah, Macron might be trying to flex his muscles in advance of elections because he's probably feeling a little bit weak and wants to show a bit of bravado, but, potentially.
Too sure. I think the fishermen are very passionate about what they do, so I think that's probably why it's happened so fast, because they care so much about their livelihood.
Yeah, probably he feels a bit isolated. I think at some point it felt like everyone was against him in a way, and I guess it's more trying to also show his muscles and trying to portray that we are a strong country and yeah, we can stand by ourselves. But you always need neighbors, you always need relationships and everything.
I can tell. Probably if there is a fight right now, Boris and Macron are there, so they are responsible. But I don't know what happened if it was other people in the lead of the two countries.
I think there's a powder keg that was always waiting to kind of explode with this, in the sense that you've got different countries that have taken different steps with regards to how they've suffered under Brexit, under COVID, and you've also got this other extra issue with regards to AUKUS, isn't it? I think it's the deal between the US, the UK and Australia for some marine production, I think. So that also had a major effect in relation to psyche, and this is as much a political game as it is about fish. I mean, fish are the secondary point here. This is more of a, it's being used as a pawn.
A quick look at the statistics shows the comparatively small value of the fishing industry to both countries, but the potentially massive economic cost to both sides of this conflict. In 2020, France exported 21 billion euros of goods and services to the UK. The UK exported 27 billion euros in the same year. By contrast, in 2019, the UK's entire fishing industry was worth 1.6 billion euros, and France's was worth 1.4 billion euros. This means that the entire value of both fishing industries put together is worth just 6% of the combined value of trade between the two countries. This suggests it's not about the fish, but about the principle. France and Britain have been old allies and even built the supersonic Concorde aircraft together and started Airbus. So what, in the public's opinion, has gone wrong between these two countries?
I don't know, maybe the two characters, they don't understand each other. Each one wants the best for the country, I don't know.
Exactly, so there was Concorde, there's the Eurotunnel, which is also another huge, huge project between the UK and France. So I really don't know what's happening at the moment. That's why I keep saying the big boys need to go back on the table, sit down, be mature, iron out all this crazy stuff that's happening, especially at this time of the pandemic and everything else. People need to come together and talk rather than just all this rhetoric about I'm the big boy, you're nothing and everything else.
I think it's a real shame that, you know, the relationship has broken down over, you know, the last couple of years. There's a lot bigger things for us to be focusing on and working on together at the moment. So it's a real shame we can't see eye to eye and get on with it.
I just think that Brexit's had so many knock-on effects, hasn't it, really? So the Condé and the Cordial is no longer there, I don't think. So it's all very sad, all very sad.
I think, you know, the history of Britain and France, you know, only recently have they been working together, you know, probably in the EU, since the era of the EU. I think maybe, you know, we're taking two separate paths now. I think, you know, you have people, I know France are very big proponents of the European Union, and they're quite,
bureaucrats not only in France but in Brussels as well. We're sort of going in a different direction, so maybe, you know, it's that old continental divide. You know, we're not on the continent, we don't really have the same values per se as them, so we're just going in two different directions.
You know, it's all about power, I guess. It's whenever you got two big nations that are raised together at one time in the history. Now, you know, it's about like showing which one can be the biggest. Now there is two different powers. France stay in Europe, UK is out. You have to show that UK is still a strong country even though they left Europe. But France is still a big country even though by remaining by Europe. So it's going to be a context like that. After we know that France and UK can stay together, we got like maybe the submarines agreement that could be going on. So, you know, it's beefing on the power, but still friend on another one. I don't think it's a lot of matter. It's just on the today's day it's like that, but it could be changed in a couple of years, a couple of times.
Well, I'd like to think that there's something, no damage that's, you know, we can't fix and unsustainable. But I'd like to think that also, if you look at, the backdrop of the last 2 years and the conversations that we've had as a nation, you know, I think that's led itself to, you know, us looking outwards also, when maybe we should be looking at, you know, ourselves and our own infrastructure and, you know, how we're best set up for the future. Because really, on the eve of Brexit, we had Dominic Raab saying, "I didn't know Dover was so important." So really, we, you know, you've got to look at the governance behind the country as well. And are we best set up to cope with these kind of structural issues in the short, medium term?
Maybe because they are same, jealous, like who is too close to each other, have competition, like two brothers, like two sisters, I don't know, maybe two same. And the same story, the same relationship with other countries and all that kind of thing, maybe jealous, maybe other fights. Interesting.
Well, some things you get right and then other things it takes a bit longer to get right, so I hope they work on it.
I think you have to ask Macron. It seems to be down to him causing all this fuss. I don't know if the French people feel the same way as him, but it'd be interesting to get their views.
In 1975, the United Kingdom and Iceland had a dispute about fishing rights. It was called the Cod War, and Iceland won. Can there be a winner between Britain and France this time? And if so, how and why?
I don't think there'll be a winner. I just think there's a whole load of, you know, people trying to show off, you know, basically, for want of a better word, almost like a competition between each other. I think it will just die down. I don't think anything will come of it.
Well, with fighting, as you have described, is going on, I don't think there is ever a winner. Eventually, every fight ends with a sit-down and an agreement. So the sooner they do that, the better for everyone involved, I guess.
In my opinion, it's not about winning or no. It's just about getting the best, like the best you can do for your people. So the French government was the best for the French fishers, so such does the UK government for their fishers. So at the end, it's all about what you're gonna get at the end. But I'm not sure anyone can win. Just it's gonna be just like who's gonna have the best agreement and people like appear in the country. That's all it's gonna be about.
No, there will be no winner. That's typical of a rule. There's no winner. There's much. It's a lose-lose or a win-win. So we have to find an agreement. Otherwise, it's ridiculous. To me, it's ridiculous. We have to find an agreement, and there will be no winner, for sure.
I think they're going to lose both sides, yeah. Because if they enter into a conclusion, you know, which one pushes to one to another, you know, I don't think they're going to win, neither of them.
I don't think you can both be winners. I think we've got to come to a compromise and get on with it.
There's a war mentality in this country always. We like to think of things in that kind of guise. But I really think that if you look at the next kind of few years and the bedding in of Brexit, we've really got to get past that and try and rebuild as a country. And we need our partners to help us do that. So, you know, I'd like to think that obviously Boris and Macron can be on the same page at some point and look at common agreement and what unites us rather than what divides.
I think it's like most relationships, eh? Go through a rocky bit and hopefully we'll get it back on track. But, no, it's just not nice to see, is it?
I think, you know, the British at the moment, you know, quite frankly, should be eating more of their own fish rather than exporting it. And maybe this might cause us to try and actually stop selling it all abroad get it sold over here, which could be a benefit. But I think there's much more iterations to come in this war at the moment.
I think probably both will lose out in the long run. I think both fishermen will always want to get in each other's waters, I think, and so they can never really be a winner.
They lose always. Fight is always a losing game. I don't know, but I don't know what will happen with that boat. I will follow that story.
This is a lose-lose situation. It's not a win-win situation for either. It's a lose-lose situation. I mean, at the end of the day, we're both in Europe. You know, you can't separate Britain from Europe. They're still our biggest trading partner. Actually, it's number one trading partner. And then you've got the Americans, and then you have other trading blocks. So I think the best thing is just to come back on the talk and be mature about it. No one's going to win this one. UK or France, no one's going to win this one. To win is to talk.
Well, yeah, because that fish is obviously going off, so that's going to be a waste of stock. And yeah, there could be other issues. You can't just have that boat sitting there. It's probably stopping other boats from getting out. So yeah, it's going to have a knock-on effect. It needs to be resolved pronto, really, I think.
In the past, the UK and France have worked closely together. They jointly built the Concorde supersonic airliner, which led to the establishment of the world-beating Airbus aviation business. But with the French president and the British Prime Minister both weathering a very public conflict between the two nations, there is no sign of what used to be called an entente cordiale today. The UK and France have been locked in a bitter standoff about fishing rights. But the true dispute is not about fish at all. After evidence that French politicians want the UK to be punished for leaving the European Union, this has become a very public argument between old allies. And while this will not lead to war, the history of European politics tells us that when two large European nations collide, there are no winners, only degrees of losing.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
Humanity.
الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh and welcome to IRIB English Radio and you are listening to the program for humanity. We are looking at human rights from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam. We said, if you look at human rights, there is no one on the face of earth that has applied it like Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullahi alayhi. That even the 12th Imam, Imam al-Mahdi ajallahu ta'ala farjah sharif, when he comes, he will go on the same tradition and path of his grandfather, Amir al-Mu'mineen. When it came to equality, so we spoke about justice before and how Amir al-Mu'mineen viewed it. When it comes to equality, Amir al-Mu'mineen, it tried his best to establish equality and fairness amongst people. But first, he tried to establish such a concept in the minds of people, because everything begins with education. If the people are not educated, obviously, they're not going to be fair to one another. So he began by trying to educate people about the concept of fairness and equality. And he began by reminding them who the human being is. So he started from the beginning. And he says, Mali ibn Adami wal Fakhr. What is with the human being and the sons of Adam and pride and fame and trying to, you know, assume power? While awwalahu nutfatun wa akhruhu jifa. He began as a sperm. And at the end, he's a corpse. So the beginning of a human being is najis, because we know that sperm and semen is najis. So a human being begins with a sperm, and he begins as a semen, and he ends as a dead corpse. And both of these two, if they are touched, you be considered najis. You need to, with dead body, you need to do ghusl. And with semen, you need to do tahara. So this is the reality of a human being. He says, if you look at yourself as a human, that's your initiation point and your end. That's how you began, that's how you will end. So what is it that makes you have so much pride that you think you are better than other people? So you see how he tries to get into the minds of people. And then he moves even a stage and a step further in trying to educate people into who they are, and they should be fair with one another. He says, فَكُلُّكُمْ لُآدَمْ. For all of you, back, go back and belong to Adam, because we are the lineage of Adam, alayhi salam. وَآدَمُ مِنْ تُرَابْ. Adam himself was made from mud. And obviously now, in our values, mud is valueless. Mud has no value. It's the lowest form of anything. So he says, why should you have such a pride when it comes to yourselves and trying to deal with one another and trying to be fair with one another and compare yourself to other people? You're all the same, from the same father and from the same source, which is mud. If one of us was made from gold, he could say, yeah, I am better. But we're all the same. So he begins with educating people first and foremost. Now let us take a break and then inshallah we continue.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program for humanity coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Then Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, not only did he educate people about who they were and how they began, and that they need to be humble and to be fair to one another and they should not divide and have this division between them, and one person thinks he's better than others. He goes further and he says, when it comes to the fact that your pride, because most of the things initiate or start from having that pride, that I believe that I am better than other people. So he comes and he tries to educate people in that concept itself. He says, Alhamdulillah, alladhi labasa al-izza wal-kibriya. A glory be to Allah, for He is the one who wore the garments of glorification and pride. واختارهم لنفسه دون خلقه. And He chose them to Himself, not to His servants, not His creation. So I have to keep in mind that when it comes to pride and glory, it only belongs to Allah. Honor and pride are Allah's traits, are Allah's attributes, not mine, not yours. If I try to put them on, the garment of honor and pride, the Imam says, وَجَعَلَهُمَا حُمًا وَحَرَمًا. He made them lava, He made them fire, and forbidden عَلَى غَيْرِهِ, for anyone beside Him. فَاعْتَبْرُوا بِمَا فَعَلَ إِبْلِيسِ. You have a classical example to learn from, which is Iblis himself, and see what happened to him when he tried to, I don't know, argue or fight with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or try to put on the garment of pride that was belonged to Allah, and see what happened to him. إِذْ حَبَطَ عَمَلَهُ الطَّوِيلُ وَجُهْدُهُ الْجَهِيدُ. For all his long years, thousands of years of worship, and he put so much effort into worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it was all nullified, was all gone. Why? Because he tried to put that pride that I am better than human beings, for I was made from fire and they are made from mud. And the Imam says, وَقَدْ عَبَدَ اللَّهِ سِتَّةِ آلَافِ سَنَةٍ. He worshipped Allah 6,000 years. لَا يَدْرِي أَمْ مِنْ سِنِيِ الدُّنْيَا أَمْ مِنْ سِنِيِ الْآخِرَةِ. We don't know these 6,000 years. Is it the afterlife years or the dunya years? Because we know that 1 year or 1 day to Allah is like 50,000 days here. So this 60,000, is it in Allah's timing or is it human timing? And he says he lost it all in 1 hour. Right? Just one conversation with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In 1 hour, how? He says, an kibarin, by just being pride. So when me and you, when we want to have this pride in ourselves, and I think that I am better than other people, and I should be treated differently, I shouldn't be treated equally, then I'm simply trying to have that pride that belongs to Allah. If I want to be honored on top of other people, then obviously I am trying to seek Allah's honor. I'm trying to wear that garment. When I want to be treated as a VIP, then I am obviously challenging Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala over his pride and his honor. So Amir al-Mu'mineen, in order to get people to become fair and to become just and equal to one another, is by reminding them of their origins and reminding them the stories of those before them who compared themselves. Now sometimes me and you during our life, we might do these things without realizing. I might look at myself based on the knowledge I have, based on the title I have, based on the job I have, or my status in the community. I think that I am better than other people, and I want to be treated differently. And I am fighting Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala over his garment of honor and pride without realizing it. So we need to be very careful here. We will continue this debate. We will continue this talk, inshallah, in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You heard was
IRIB English Radio Program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.